This is 100 Things I'll Miss When I'm Dead. I'm Michael Colville Anderson. Welcome to My Happy Place, my podcast where I self-medicate against my constant overthinking and anxiety about my own mortality with tiny happy pills of positivity and reflection. Writing this podcast starts with rough notes, bits and pieces, until I start rifling through my mental pockets for loose memories and experiences. One small topic balloons into something meatier. I follow breadcrumbs backwards in my brain. Oh yeah, that happened. Ah yes, I remember that man or that woman. Maybe I'm a memory detective on a research project. Maybe I'm my own Indiana Jones raiding my lost arc of life events. Although, I probably just look like a guy who can't find his keys. Piecing together these fragmented moments of clarity is one thing, but I have noticed how people so often emerge out of the dusk of time. Not the main characters that co-star with me in one memory or another, but the minor characters that were pivotal to the dramaturgy in one episode way back in an early season of my life series. Humans who haven't appeared in my head basically since that time. Destined to be long forgotten until they suddenly make a comeback because of this podcast. And as I dust off the memory of them and shine it up, so many emotions and impressions come to light. There may be an element of retro-romanticizing in play, absolutely, but nonetheless, I am seeing people for the first time in decades. Ghosts, in a way. Many minor characters, but also humans who left an indelible impression on me, even though I had forgotten about them. There are a whole bunch of these characters in this episode, and I can't help but sit here thinking about them, wondering what became of them, trying to figure out what I'd say if I met them again. I doubt that many of them would remember me. The impression was probably a one-way street. Imagine the mammoth task of trying to find all these people in your life and having a coffee or a glass of wine with them. Instead, maybe we should just get down to business. Welcome to episode 10. Number 47, Donkey Kong. It's interesting how many of these 100 things have a firm and fertile root system in my younger years. Is it the same for you and the list in your head that might be developing as you listen to this podcast? There I am, out there in the world, living, hopefully, an interesting life, experiencing countries, cities, cultures. Meeting fascinating people to talk to, learn from, have sex with, laugh with. And when I sit down to make a list, I get into a time machine and head backwards through the decades. Like back to 1981, to a large and, incredibly ugly strip mall called Heritage Mall on Flint Road. Still beyond ugly after all these years, according to Street View, as well as not so creatively rebranded as Heritage Hill. More specifically, a video game arcade. Long disappeared, that was located just inside the main door to the left, a sliver of a space, about 4 meters wide, but long. I started frequenting this arcade probably around the age of 12. As I mentioned in a previous segment, cinemas are the most consistent temple-like spaces in my life. But this place, this place, man. This was our Sistine Chapel. Along each wall was a row of arcade games, with the newest games closest to the door. In this chapel, our Michelangelos were Japanese game designers, who painted the space with glorious flashing lights. The choir was the cacophony of the nasal video game sound effects of the age. It was the most beautiful thing I had ever seen. Our holy incense was that odorless aroma of male preteen and teen hormones, filling the air like a fog, so powerful that it repelled all females within a wide radius, except for one. She was blonde and about 14, so absolutely unattainable. She kept to herself. She was some kind of supernatural goddess, just for being there in our space, but also for being better than most of us at many of the games. When you entered, there was a desk on the right. At that desk was Reg, the kindly owner of the arcade. He was our bishop and a veritable alchemist. He possessed the magical skill to transform dimes, nickels, and pennies, as well as dollar bills, into the most valuable currency imaginable for young people in that window of time in human history. Quarters. Oh man, quarters. They were worth their weight in gold. Most of the arcade games cost 25 cents, so my entire existence was focused on acquiring them. Even if you had a pocket full of change and were buying a chocolate bar at a corner store, you would never pay in quarters. You would take the time to count out the other coins. You never knew when you might need that quarter. I went to dubious lengths to acquire them, and I blame Donkey Kong for that. It was a new game in 1981, and I fell hard for it. But it was a new game, so it cost 50 cents. 50 cents. That's like $2 million in today's money for a 13-year-old kid. I had pretty decent success at mining small change from all the winter jackets in the closet by our front door at home. But that was a once-a-year Eldorado. Once I depleted that resource, I started going into my mom's purse, never taking more than 50 cents at a time. I can remember, with great clarity, the feeling of walking down to the arcade with quarters in my pocket. It was thrilling. If they were contraband quarters, the numbing guilt only amplified the thrill. I told my mom when I was in my 30s that I stole quarters out of her purse to play Donkey Kong when I was 12, and she was like, "Yeah, I know." Everyone had their game. Mine was Donkey Kong. Some kids were really good at one game. Others were pretty good at many different ones. Back then, there were dozens of magazines about arcade games on the market, and they featured high score lists from cities all over North America. I made it to third place in Donkey Kong in my city. Oh, seeing my name on that list was better than winning a gold medal at the Olympics. Once I got better at Donkey Kong, I could steal 50 cents and spend an hour playing one game, with a crowd of other kids in a half circle behind me, oohing and aahing at close calls and amazing moves. I also took my place in those half circles. There was one guy, super old, like 17, who was the resident saint in our chapel. We were in awe of him. I remember noticing him once in the half circle behind me while I was playing Donkey Kong. Me. He was watching me. When I was done, he nodded and said, "Good game." I was speechless. The other kids were too. Jaws on the floor. God had just reached out with a celestial finger and almost touched Adam. Good game. Damn. This guy was good at so many games, and our teen hormones went off the charts when we heard that he was going to try and break the world record at Centipede. It took a very long time. I can't remember how long exactly, but definitely more than 24 hours. We stood there mesmerized for hours watching him. Reg had placed a fancy-looking velvet rope barrier around him to give him space. He did it too, man. World champion. But back in those days, it probably lasted for a week before someone else beat it. We didn't care. Right there, in an anonymous strip mall in the early 1980s, in a random suburb in a sprawling North American city, we had a hero. A hero greater than the hockey stars on TV. Good game. If you remember the episode when I talk about crying, yeah. You would think that I would have a vintage Donkey Kong arcade game standing in my living room right this moment, right? Okay, I've thought about that for many years, actually. But as we know from the podcast, I'm not a fan of owning things. I do have a little console that plugs into the TV and that has six vintage games on it. It's a fun retro thing to do once in a while. If I do want to play Donkey Kong, or if I need to play Donkey Kong. There's a bar in Copenhagen filled with two floors of vintage games. You buy a drink and get a free key card to all the games. If I look over my shoulder, I can see the 12-year-old Michael looking through the years at me, and he is in awe. Alcohol and free arcade games? Could the future be any more fabulous than that? Wow. Whenever I'm in Tokyo, I make sure to find the time to go to one of the many arcades. I don't know most of the games, and many appeal to the quirky Japanese taste, but I'll still find games to play. Soaking up the atmosphere, traveling back in time to really what was a narrow window of time in my life. I played arcade games throughout my teens, but not like this. This was that little pocket where I was old enough to be allowed to go out and do stuff like that by myself and wasn't interested in anything else. It ended when I was 13, and a far greater force came along and ruined it, a force more powerful than anything I had ever imagined. Girls. I soon pulled up stakes and moved to a new temple farther down the street. Lloyd's Roller Rink. There were arcade games there, of course, but everything revolved around trying to get girls to notice you. Staring longingly out across the savanna of the roller rink at all of those beautiful, graceful, and, oh, mysterious gazelles, with names like Cindy and Jody. And the primary life goal was mastering roller skating backwards so you could ask a girl for a slow skate. But yeah, Donkey Kong, as the defining holy grail of a period of time in my life. I've read that people with dementia respond to music from their youth. Like my fear of dying, my fear of dementia is also very real. But to my loved ones, if I end up suffering from it, just put on Duran Duran and the sound effects of Donkey Kong, and let's see what happens. Number 48, the prairies and other flat expanses. If I'm to choose a favorite geography, it would easily be flat expanses and preferably prairies. When my parents emigrated from Denmark in 1953, they chose to live in a city on the Canadian prairies, or rather, at the edge of them, in the gently undulating foothills leading to the Rocky Mountains. In effect, I straddled two vastly different landscapes. The mountains were always visible in the distance, and I spent a great deal of time in them, fascinated by them. As mountains go, that stretch of the Rockies is one of the most spectacular on the planet. I was, however, drawn to the prairies instead. In that corner of the world, the sky is all dominant. Big Sky Country is one of the nicknames for the region, with good reason. It's everywhere you look. Out on the vastness of the prairies, if you extended your arms out to both sides, it felt like the horizon was lower than your hands. The curvature of the earth felt discernible and epic. I reveled as a young man at the feeling of being the largest thing for miles around, and yet feeling like I was the most insignificant thing in the whole world. You can see massive storms pass, with thunderheads that mushroom up to amazing heights, and realize that that storm is probably 50 kilometers away or more. You are hypnotized when driving down country roads so straight and unending. You know, if you draw a road disappearing into the distance on a piece of paper, how the two lines intersect at the end? That point is always visible on some of those roads, and you never seem to get closer. I have seen many of the landscapes that the planet has to offer and been amazed by them. I am always drawn back to flat expanses. Be it a flat desert like the Taklamakan in China, the Red Center of Australia, the steppes of Russia and Central Asia, it's where I feel most at ease, my vision unobstructed. I spend a lot of time contemplating how much the landscape in which a person grows up influences that person in life. Are we the product of the dominant geography of our childhood? Are you who you are today in some way because you grew up in the mountains, forest, desert, on the coast, on a tract of flat farmland? I guess the same applies to whether you grew up in a finely manicured suburb, deep in the bustle of the slums of Kolkata, a small village on a Norwegian fjord, high up in an Asian apartment building, and so on. There are probably no answers to this question, only the intuitive guesses in our heads. I grew up in a humdrum suburb built in the 1950s, but I was drawn at a young age towards the downtown. And ever since, I have chosen to live as urban as I can get. Maybe the dominant geography of where you grew up made you run towards something else. But that would still indicate that it had an influence. In smaller countries, there is more uniformity for many reasons, but the geography and landscape is certainly one of them. Everyone in Denmark basically shares the same weather, and complain about it in chorus. Norwegians share a relationship with the fjords and the overwhelming landscape of their country. Citizens of small island nations have the same kind of common denominator. In countries that spread across different landscapes and climates, the differences are greater. There has got to be some societal effect when you have parts of the population wandering around beaches in shorts and t-shirts all year and others facing snowstorms in the winter. The same fascination with flat expanses doesn't apply to the ocean for me. I have sailed in the Pacific for weeks with nothing but water and sky. It appeals to me, but not the same as a landscape. Not by far. I prefer a coast, watching the sea crash into the land with all that power and majesty. Although a super wide, flat expanse of beach, a broad purgatory between land and sea, that's something I can work with. But yeah, at the end of the day, give me the prairies. Let me continue to wonder what influence they exert on my life. Number 49, tattoos. It took me a very long time to get my first tattoo. I had pondered it for years and had all sorts of sketches in my notebooks, mostly simple graphic symbols from ancient cultures. When I was younger, it was still kind of a crazy thing to do and not at all as widespread as it is today, certainly here in Denmark. I was super close to getting one in Auckland in 1993, but the price was prohibitive to a broke backpacker. I couldn't possibly know it at that time, but I'm glad I didn't end up getting it. Because in 1995, I ended up getting married in Las Vegas, and we got matching tattoos instead of wedding rings. A life is just a collection of, hopefully, good storytelling. So that one trumped the previous idea, by far. My Danish girlfriend at the time was working at a summer camp in the US, so we concocted the idea that I would pick her up when she was done, and we would embark on a tacky tourist tour of America. In a sports car, of course. Times Square, Washington, D.C., Jack Daniel's Distillery, Graceland, the Dallas Ranch, the Grand Canyon, eating at truck stops and staying in crappy motels the whole way. Then we would roll into Vegas, check into a motel on the strip with a vibrating bed and mirrors on the ceiling and get married at the Little White Chapel after getting tattoos. It all went according to plan. Man, what an amazing trip. We ended up skipping the Dallas Ranch, but the motel on the strip had shag carpet that extended halfway up the walls, so it all balanced out. We had a simple Viking symbol that we were going to get on our ring fingers. The whole wedding ring thing isn't really as big a thing here in Denmark as it is in other countries, but the tattoo artist advised against it. Tattoos on the hands fade pretty quickly, so we used our backup plan, a Bronze Age symbol from Scandinavia of the sun, with our initials on it, high on our left arms near the shoulder. We decided against getting married at the drive-through window because we thought it would be fun to walk down the aisle. We wanted Elvis to marry us, but that guy had to be booked 3 weeks in advance. We said our vows as Love Me Tender played on a cassette and then went and saw a Las Vegas show, as you do. Then it was off to Disneyland and then north to Canada to surprise my mother with the news. She just rolled her eyes and said, "Oh, for heaven's sake." When you're the fifth kid, it took more than that to surprise her. The problem with that tattoo was that it was too high up on my arm. You couldn't see it when I was wearing a t-shirt. So, the next year, I decided to get a new one. Copenhagen has more tattoo parlors per capita than anywhere else. But I ended up at Denmark's oldest female tattoo artist, a grumpy old woman named Roxy, famous for being grumpy and swearing like a sailor. I got another simple Scandinavian Bronze Age symbol of a man in a ship, lower down on my right arm, below the t-shirt line. Fast forward to 2012. Some men buy a Porsche when they have a midlife crisis. Yeah, I decided on another tattoo. I had two ideas. One was a quote by Søren Kierkegaard, "Life must be lived forwards, but is understood backwards," except in Danish and in a bold Helvetica font, in your face. The other was an urban planning map of Paris from 1910. Both were to be placed wrapped around my right shoulder. After chatting with some of the new hipster tattoo dudes and getting tired listening to their babble, I went back to Roxy's. Her daughter and granddaughter both tattoo there one day a week. It's a family thing. And I spoke with her daughter, who's about my age. I showed her the quote and she was all like, "Oh, everyone's getting texts these days." So I showed her the map of Paris and where I wanted it placed. Roxy herself was inking someone in the background, but stopped suddenly and came over to the counter. "What's all this about a map?" "Mom, he wants this map around his shoulder like this. It's Paris." Roxy looked and then mumbled, "Huh, never fucking seen that before," and then walked back to her client. "Mom, you've done over 30,000 tattoos and you've never seen a map?" Ah, there was some asshole 20 years ago with a treasure map on his stomach, but yeah, no. Me? I was just standing there watching them talk. Then I saw her daughter's jaw drop. She was incredulous. I just said, I think I'm going to get the map. And she just nodded and said, yeah, do that. It took two sessions lasting a few hours each, but it was done, and I loved it. I Googled back then, tattoo, map, and hardly anything came up. So that was almost as cool as Roxy's grumpy approval. A year later, I decided to expand it. I got my favorite street in Montreal added to Paris. The plan evolved to gradually get a map of my favorite streets in my favorite cities. Around that time, my TV series, The Life-Size City, was about to start filming. I was sitting at the bar at my local wine bar and texting with my producer in Canada. I got an idea. I wrote, hey man, what if while we're filming in a city and there's a segment that really touches me, you know, moves me, I could get a map of that part of the city tattooed on camera at the end of the episode. He texted back in all caps. Oh my God, would you do that? That is fucking great television. I guess it would be, but you know what? I just like the idea. So that happened. I now have smaller tattoos from 15 cities added to my urban map. Still a work in progress, but yeah, I take my work seriously, I guess. I like tattoos, and I like the historical aspect. So many cultures had this ink tradition. Google Greenlandic facial tattoos. They are so cool. I wouldn't get any on my face or neck, though, but that's just me. Then there's a German museum that I think is cool. When you die, they'll remove your tattoo, dry it out, and stretch it flat, exhibiting it in the museum. The trick here is dying in Germany, since most other countries don't allow this. I remember reading how tattoos were all the rage back in Victorian England. All the modest dress, but even the fancy people had them underneath. Then there's the story that if you were a sailor back in the romantic sailing days, and you got the alphabet tattooed on the sole of your foot, you would drink free at sailor dive bars around the world, because apparently it's the most painful tattoo to get. I don't know if that's just an urban legend, and I'm not going to Google it. I like the story as it is. The permanence of tattoos is daunting, but it is and remains a part of you. It's your art. You are the canvas. You express yourself through a timeless, ritual art form. Number 50, hitchhiking. Hitchhiking is like a landline phone or a fax machine. So many people these days have heard of it, but never seen it or tried it. It is wild how something that was so normal disappeared so quickly. Well, perhaps not that wild. The book, The Culture of Fear, by British sociologist Frank Furedi, outlines why in great detail. How our societies are safer than at any point in human history. So now we go around looking for stuff to be scared of. And entire industries have evolved to sell us stuff based on the fears that they themselves construct. Most relevant is the fear of the other. And I guess this has impacted hitchhiking. When I was young, it was a romantic concept. All my older siblings, I'm sure, had done it at some point in the 70s. I wanted a piece of it. In the summer of 85, I saw a classified ad in the newspaper. I don't know why I was reading the classified ads. Maybe looking for jobs. But hey, a guy was driving from Alberta to Ontario and wanted company for the 3,330-kilometer trip. I called him up, and we arranged it. My dad dropped me off at a hotel where the guy was staying. I was 17, just out of high school. I had no plans to go to Ontario, but I found one pretty quick. There was a girl in Ontario, and an adventure to get to her. So off we went. He was a nice guy, moving back to Ontario. He was driving and his family had flown ahead. Good conversation. I remember listening to a long talk radio interview with Frank Zappa. I remember being amazed that the musician who wrote Why Does It Hurt When I Pee had such a brilliant brain, so articulate and fascinating. Fast forward to 1990. I was living in Melbourne and heading to Bali, and my girlfriend at the time was off to Hong Kong. We both needed to get to Darwin in the Northern Territory, so we decided to hitch. It took three rides to get to the key intersection near Port Augusta, north of Adelaide, all with incredibly friendly people. The intersection in question has two options. One road heads west to Perth, the other north to Darwin. It was slim pickings waiting for a ride there. We were getting to the point where we were considering finding a place to camp for the night. But you know, Australia. Snakes, scorpions, killer spiders, and all that. Then a car rolled up, heading in the wrong direction. This guy had passed us before, but then he drove on for 30 minutes before turning around and coming back to get us. He couldn't bear the thought of us having to spend the night in the brushlands. Amazing. He took us to Coober Pedy, where most of the world's opals are mined. We kept on moving north to Alice Springs, where we climbed Uluru, formerly known as Ayers Rock. You can't do that anymore. Uluru is sacred to its indigenous custodians, the Anangu people, and since 2017, you can no longer climb it. There was no talk of that back in those days. I'm stuck between being glad to have experienced it and being sorry if I offended anyone. On to Darwin we went. It didn't take many rides in total that whole hitching trip because there are so few destinations. Also, everyone said the same thing. Better to pick up people than leave them in the desert. And yes, I felt at ease in those flat expanses in the heart of Australia. I don't remember much of Darwin. My girlfriend and I were parting. I would visit her in Hong Kong after Indonesia, but for all the freestyle goodness of backpacking relationships, there is also uncertainty. All I remember is Sinead O'Connor's Nothing Compares to You, the hit song of the time, which we heard over and over, and the spinning ceiling fan in a hostel room as we wondered what would become of us. Months later, I hitched from Copenhagen to Hamburg and then continued south on my way to live in London, competing for rides and the best places to stand at with other hitchhikers. I got a ride with a young man in leather pants, driving a beat-up car at a roundabout outside of Hamburg. He was heading south to Cologne to pick up his girlfriend, and then, he told me, they would drive to Berlin because Pink Floyd was playing at the Berlin Wall. Did I want to come? Yeah. It ended up only being Roger Waters, and I ended up so far from the stage, but I soaked it up, man. It was legend. I slept in a park that night, and then continued hitching south to London the next day to live with the girlfriend from Darwin. Fast forward again to 1993. I was back living in Melbourne, this time without any real plan. My girlfriend at the time, a different one, suggested that we hitchhike to Perth. Of course, I was all in. And then I found myself at that same crossroads near Port Augusta, this time on the other highway, heading west. We got one long ride to Kalgoorlie, still one of the coolest names for a town in the world, with a great guy in a Land Rover, driving along the longest straight stretch of highway in the world, carving its way through the desert. We took the train to Perth from there. While hitchhiking seems to have faded, I suppose ride sharing is similar. It's a popular way to cross the country in Denmark and, I suppose, many other places. You arrange it in advance and share expenses. Same, same, but different. Less romance, less trepidation, less wondering, how long do I have to wait? Should I move farther down the road? Should I make a bigger sign? Where do I sleep if I don't get a ride by nightfall? Where am I going? Where will I end up? What lies at the end of this road or ahead of me in the rest of my life? You've been listening to 100 Things I'll Miss When I'm Dead. If you like what you're hearing, slap some shiny stars on the rating on iTunes, and you can buy me a coffee. Check out how over at buymeacoffee.com/Michael, M-I-K-A-E-L. I'm Michael Koval Anderson. Catch you next time, and thanks for listening.